We asked a simple question. We said, given a connection, given a pathway in the brain, what is the other stuff in its immediate three-dimensional environment? What does it pass through? If you picture the paths of the brain being like a bowl of spaghetti, you would expect nothing in particular. You would expect that its environment is complicated and arbitrary, and you would expect that each connection is a narrow, discrete object. What we discovered is that the fiber architecture of the brain is more or less as simple as you can possibly imagine. Each pathway, rather than being an isolated pathway, is a component in a three-dimensional grid. The pathways in the top of the brain are all organized like woven sheets, so that the fibers only run in two directions in the sheet and then in a third direction perpendicular to the sheet. And these sheets all stack together so that the entire connectivity of the brain follows three precisely defined directions. Now, these directions are a little bit hard to spot because in embryological life, they're simple directions, but then in the adult brain, they get very folded and curled up. And so that surface of the brain that you see with all of its folds has pulled the wires around with it, and so these three directions have now become greatly curved. But fundamentally, the geometry of the brain is described by a three-dimensional grid. The fiber pathways are not really isolated structures. In a sense, every pathway in the brain has a relationship to every other pathway given by their mutual position in this single universal grid structure. This grid structure is strongly conserved across different species. So you see the same structure we looked at a half a dozen different primates, including humans, and more or less the same structure is always present, but as you go from small, simpler brains up to larger and more complicated brains, it gets more highly curved and develops certain branches and turns. But the basic theme of this structure is preserved across. So as a result of this, we now have a way of seeing the structure of the brain as a single unified whole. It no longer seems like a bunch of uncorrelated or isolated connections. The entire connectome fits together into a single framework which expresses developmental rules, and we speculate or hypothesize functional rules as well.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Today is August 14th. Welcome back to the show. What you're going to hear today is the audio to a video, and if you can, I highly recommend the video. But I've edited this in such a way that I think it translates to audio nicely. The video is available on the site, and if you check the show notes for this episode, you'll also see about a 10-minute tutorial that goes over what we talk about most of the show. So if you have 10 minutes for video today, I highly recommend checking that out. So there's this piece of software called the brain. It's also known as the personal brain. And I found it to be a very useful tool for not only personal organization and creativity, but really for historical research. And as I listened back to the last show that I did about the small Murray Rothbard book, I realized, how useful this would have been for people to have in front of them while they were listening to that. I think being able to picture what I was talking about, that's a lot to process. And this is a piece of software that can help us process some of these more complex ideas and relationships. And I'm finding it very useful, and I'm really enthusiastic about using the brain in the future. That's it. I'm really excited about some of the stuff that's coming soon. So stay tuned. You know how they say that?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special video presentation of School Sucks Podcast. We're going to try and make this work as audio as well. I'm Brett Benatt. And with me tonight, Paul Verge from DVC Media. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks.
Well, it's great to have you on the show again, and Richard Grove from TragedyandHope.com.
Couldn't make the Ustream work tonight, so that's why it's pre-taped.
Ustream couldn't make itself work. We were supposed to be streaming this live. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. But I want to say thank you, because you've been running around doing work, trying to... Well, and we're going to have a much higher production quality in the end anyway.
Just a few hours ago, this studio was working for another interview, and so I was trying to make the webcams work, but... We just got to go with this. This is easy for us now.
Yeah, this is very relaxed. And a relaxed mind is a creative and a productive mind. And we're going to talk about that in more detail tonight. We're actually going to be discussing and demoing a piece of software called The Brain. You know, I was thinking about my experience in education and my experience as a student in school. And the only organizational tool that we were ever provided that I can remember, and if you guys have others, certainly feel free to put them in. The first one was the outline. The good old outline,
sure.
Where you just do a Roman numeral one and then you list some ideas. And then the bubble diagram, which was just like kind of a crappy picture of the same outline. You know, it didn't really change much, didn't really make it more flexible or allow for more insight or creativity in any way. So basically, and this fits the pattern of school pretty nicely, here, fit your thinking into this model that was created before you got here a long time ago. I also had a lot of experience, in addition to being a student and a teacher and a tutor, working with the SAT. And on the SAT, there's a real test, I think, worth devoting some extra time to when I do these classes, because I think there's some good lessons in it, a real test of organization and creativity. And the first thing you do on the SAT today is you write an essay. You have 25 minutes. You're given a prompt. For example, is the world changing for the better? Right? So they're usually yes or no questions, but they're very, very open-ended. In other words, you could write about almost anything. So in this very narrow window of time, you not only have to generate ideas, but you have to organize them. And often what people do is they just start writing right away. And they either wind up with a very creative essay that's terribly organized, or a very well-organized and logical essay that's bland and boring and basically a stock response to whatever the question is. Like, here's a safe, well-organized thing to write, but not really much more. So organization and creativity, I've always tried to get people to separate those into two different processes, right? Creativity or idea generation is a creative process, and you do that first. And then you look at everything that you have, and you, once you can see the landscape, once you can see the map, you say, how does that make sense? So, you know, clarity, understanding, and memory really come, I think, from this harmony between imagination or creativity and organization, which is connection and associations. So on the show tonight, we're going to talk about this software, The Brain, that I think really serves both processes very well. And I'm new to this. Rich and Paul have a considerable amount of experience with this. Rich, you were actually the one who, I think, introduced this to everybody in this community, right?
I've tried various products that... the idea is you need a capture device.
Yeah.
Let's start there before we get into the actual software.
Like, sure.
Right now I got a pad of paper, and I got a Scribo of something to write with. And so I can capture stuff on a piece of paper, but it's not necessarily in any given order. It's just kind of, you know, brainstorming how things come to me. And you can't just drag and drop things and rearrange them. So paper has its limitations.
Right.
So what you can use with technology is software that outlines things not in a linear fashion, but in a almost 3D fashion, where it would be non-linear, and it has connectivity where you can see how things connect and say, I might want to reorganize my outline based on the connectivity that I just observed through using a piece of software that can help you put some of this information in an organized manner that ignites your creativity. Because I think there's a process of collection through observation,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to organize it, which is kind of what we're talking about. But the end result of that is being able to be creative and to demonstrate intellectual self-defense. So I use it primarily to assess knowledge, to validate knowledge, to encapsulate some of the research that I've done. But you can also use it to plan a family vacation or to organize your desk at work or to improve, you know, your day at work by having everything in something that is structured. Because when it's structured and you're the one making those links and putting that structure together, inherently you are creating synapses in your brain.
Yeah.
So that learning that goes on is almost imprinted and you're programming yourself. You're starting from scratch and building your own brain model, or you can add on to someone else's or however you want to do it. I mean, that's your choice. But the idea is that once you start to interact with let me read a source and start to, you know, encapsulate that information in a meaningful way. Otherwise, you could just take notes all the time, but it's how do you process those notes in a meaningful way and integrate the contents of that into your life?
Yeah. And back to the creativity piece, and then I'll turn it over to Paul and he can add some thoughts. But on the creativity piece, and you mentioned nonlinear thinking, that really contributes to people's creativity. Now, the list making is linear, and that's how I think we often get stuck in these comfortable thinking patterns and these rule ruts. So whether we're talking about mind mapping, which is something that's existed for a long time, I have to give credit to Tony Buzan, who copyrighted that term, which is basically creating these more free-flowing visual representations of nonlinear thinking. The brain seems to also provide that you can actually have a map. You can have a visual representation of nonlinear thinking. It's easy to make a visual representation of linear thinking because it's a list or an outline. So this is not only an organizational tool, but a very valuable, creative tool as well.
I think it's also good for exercising your memory.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
A lot of people have a short attention span, and the way you lengthen your attention span is by giving your brain meaningful content to chew on and process. And I think the other dead end of the outline, as I would know it, right, as we've all learned through public schooling, is that they don't teach you that the purpose of an outline is to have an entry point, a substance point, and then an egress, an exit point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't, you know, a lot of people can write into their outline, I got a great idea for a beginning, here's the middle, but they don't know how to get out. So if you think about those things before you try to structure what you're going to write on your SAT or any other given output, think about your input, your processing, and your output.
Right,
which is
right.
The same structure that you would be communicating on a piece of paper.
Absolutely. So Paul, anything to add to our introduction to the brain here?
Well, I would say that if we recognize the apparent truth that we're all as human beings kind of conditionable, that gives us the opportunity to not only prevent being conditioned through intellectual self-defense, but to self-condition through repetition of creating good habits, right? And so the act of having something like the brain software really gives you not only the ability to organize in a tangible way that you can share with others, but every time you're looking at your brain model, you're visually anchoring this idea structure. And there's a lot of times you can nest ideas within sort of like child ideas or sub ideas.
Yeah.
So it allows you to kind of, if you've ever heard of the term memory palaces, that's a structured, ordered way of thinking where you design basically a house of an overarching idea, and then each room is a sub idea associated with that thought, and it helps people memorize, you know, hundreds or thousands of facts associated with one thing. Well, this is essentially doing it for you in a way that you can externalize it and refer to it and constantly update it, right? Like Rich was saying, with paper, once you filled the piece of paper, it's full. Like, you got to either flip it over or get a new piece. With this, because of the technology, you're just constantly updating the model as new information becomes available or new connections become relevant.
Absolutely. You know, also, I think really valuable here is the ability to counter information overload, which is a more serious problem today than ever before in history. So we have these magnificent instruments in our heads that are constantly engaging in that process that Rich just mentioned of accepting these inputs, the processing of those inputs, and then the translation of that processing into meaningful, productive action. But, you know, all throughout recorded history and even before, we see that man hasn't always been evolved enough to deal with his environment, but man has had the ability to fashion tools that help him deal with that environment better. So there's a lot of discussion today about, are we really ready, you know, on a biological level to interface with the internet? And it is, it can be overwhelming if people don't have, you know, an operator's manual for that. Wes Bertrand recently got me into the work of this Dr. Daniel Siegel, I believe is a psychologist, and his website, and I believe it's a book, is called Mindsight. And he's talked about how all of the, you know, this productive energy, a lot of it that should be, and attention that should be focused inward, is being sucked outward by this, you know, perpetually unfinished world of the internet. And that can be overwhelming because it's like there's always people to argue with. There's always new things to see. It's like there's never any sense of completion, which is very difficult. But the brain is really part of, you know, a larger picture of tools that we can use to go and interface with that environment and be more successful.
Well, I think it's a good point that you bring up about information overload. I mean, in today's culture, the one thing that we do have is too many inputs. Mm-hmm. There are too many opportunities for input. And this is where you kind of have to do what I call kung fu for your mind.
Yeah.
I had a Peace Revolution episode, I think it was 28, that was called, how to do kung fu for your mind, intellectual self-defense. And the idea is when you are presented with information, whether it be in a paper or electronically or, you know, however it's coming into contact with you, you have to do a couple quick questions on it to validate it. It's just like if someone comes to your door, you don't just open your door and let them come in. Mm-hmm. You have to question these ideas. And what you'll find is you're presented with many irrational, arbitrary ideas that can be quickly dismissed without you missing a beat in life, without you missing anything of substance of value. You can get rid of that information. Now you're left to focus in on the signal, whereas you've just discarded the noise, right? Mm-hmm. The noise is the irrational, that which does not reflect reality, and you need this information set that does reflect reality. Now, if you don't have a consistent method and a habit to sift through that information and to question it out of your off your desk, you're going to be dealing with too many inputs all the time. So one of the first things we have to do to gain our balance before we can even have enough time to learn how to use a new piece of software to make our lives easier is to start to recognize that we all are inundated unless we resist it effectively, whether it's the spam or the TV corporate news media, these sort of things. So all this information processing allows us to regain our self, our choice, our freedom in life. Mm-hmm. But if we are continuing to let those processes be eaten up, we'll never have a chance to regain our energy through learning a new skill like using a piece of software.
Sure.
But what I can say is, like just as an everyday example, you get a bunch of links every day and you don't have time to read through each and every link that you're sent, right? Mm-hmm. But you might have all these tabs open and that builds a level of anxiety. It's like, I got too many tabs open. How am I going to get these tabs closed?
Right.
Well, what I do is I go through and I read enough to identify, is this something that I need to read now, read later, or dismiss it? Most of the time it's either read now, read later. So if I have to read it later, I'll at least drop it in the brain under the proper category. And I'll know my brain can rest. I can clear that mental RAM because I've put it someplace that it's stored. It's synchronized. Even if I don't have time to look at it right now, someone else might get a chance to look at it, right? So it's still in motion. It's still doing its work. And when I get back to researching that topic, I'll click down and say, oh, there's a couple attachments I haven't, you know, had the chance to really dig into. And then I can just find them very easily.
Sure. And if it's something that can be done relatively quickly, it's generally recommended that if you have the time to do it, do it. And if not, find a way to incubate it into a system where you can recall it as necessary. And if it's just something that you might need, you know, somewhere down the road, find a reference file.
You start to become more organized and you get, let's say, like a time management brain model going on. So you might have a someday maybe file. You might have something to read later. But what I can say about you learning to use the software is a lot of it's drag and drop. I mean, you mm-hmm. can type and do a whole bunch of fancy stuff into it. But as far as like if I had 20 tabs open that I wanted to just capture those in the brain because I got to restart my computer or something like that, you can just drag and drop those in and, you know, do a search for Rockefeller. You drag this article in, do a search on Dulles, drag this article in. And it doesn't take very long to be able to just, you know, get everything clean, organized, stored, so that it's useful and you can find it in the future. Because if you don't know what your stuff is, where it is, and what it's for, it's just like a liability. Mm-hmm. So you can turn it into a resource, as I'm sure Paul can attest to, because he's had a lot of practical experience doing this.
Sure, Paul?
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to be introduced to the brain from Rich probably within a year or two of first meeting him. He's like, hey, check this out. Because I was a pretty disorganized guy, and I've made a little bit of progress, but... thanks to the brain, it's been a lot more progress than I would have made without it. You know what I mean? So in terms of like whether it's planning out scripts or planning out events or just trying to organize your own thoughts, right? People make lists and outlines for everything, but they get confused between the quality and the quantity of the tasks, really. So they'll make huge lists. And they're like, okay, I got all this stuff out that I wanted to do. But then they look at this huge list and they have no idea. Like, how am I going to tackle all this? I've externalized it from my brain, but it's just now overwhelming. And so they need to break it down to the priorities. What are the highest quality returns on the different tasks and which ones are less important. You can put them off for later. And so you've got the same thing with the brain software. Is you can have things be, you know, a parent thought, a child thought, an associated thought. And so in a way, you're kind of distinguishing what level of connection, because I think that's another thing that people can kind of realize a bit more in terms of perspectives when they're getting overwhelmed is, are you looking too closely at something, at too great a detail? Do you maybe need a bit more perspective from far away to see things in a greater context? And then that helps you get your bearings a bit better. And then you can zoom back into the level of detail that the task requires. And so in that way, you're able to kind of recenter yourself, because stress, you know, getting overwhelmed leads to stress, and stress leads to irrational actions. And then you end up adding more tasks because, you know, dealing with those kind of problems.
Sure. So we can still find ourselves stressed even, you know, without having a lot of this information or a lot of these tools, even with our, you know, best efforts to be organized. Like if I have a to-do list and it says on their website and then 2 days go by, well, now that's stressful because what does that mean? Website. My website is pretty complex. So I think what Paul, what you're talking about there is you could use the brain or a tool like the brain to take an item on a to-do list, like a project, and basically dissect it into doable actions that you could see, right? And then you say, okay, here's the next step in getting this process moving towards completion.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing, is that a lot of people might make the list and then it, you know, it goes out of their mind, or they forget the context, or they procrastinate, and they're left with, you know, added anxiety, like you said. So just having that ability to move things around from the got to do this to the okay, it's done folder. You know, if you're like stressing out about something, just go into the stuff I've done folder and look at all the stuff that you've completed in the last several months. Be like, oh yeah, it wasn't that hard. You know what I mean? And you can, there's ways to remind yourself to be more at peace with the stress of workload, right? Because everyone's got workloads of different kinds. It's about how you cope with them and organize them, and again, prioritize them. Because if you think life's about amassing the most number of numbers or friends or, you know, items from the gift shop or China or something, then you're kind of missing the point of having those quality connections and reducing the amount of things you focus on and just giving each thing that you do focus on a quality amount of attention.
Yeah, that kind of ties into another advantage that I saw of using the brain, is that there are some inspirational qualities of it. Like you talk about moving things out of a to-do list into already did that folder. Well, I mean, with the brain, you can look at it. You can actually see a visualization, which is really something that I think we take learning for granted a lot. And we can say, okay, here's what I've created. Here's what I've connected. Here's what I've synthesized. And that allows you to feel encouraged and maybe some gratitude for what you've accomplished, and to say, well, where can I go from here? What can I build on this foundation? Which I think is the same idea.
It's powerful because it allows you, if you're in a process of observing and learning about new things that you identify, well, this will help to organize that which you are identifying. So you start with the grammar, let's say the Wikipedia page. The logic is, what is that Wikipedia page, that person, in context of other people, places, and things in history that are relative to mm-hmm. it? And then the rhetoric is being able to use that model to explain to family, friends, coworkers, hey, look into this. And all they have to do is click into it, click those pages or those attachments, and everyone can share and work from the same page, which I think is fundamental. If we're going to solve some of these bigger problems, people need to have a common understanding and be able to agree and see that, okay, the definition for this is this. So here it is. It's in the model. We have a definition for this. And, you know, that's what we're building from, that sort of idea.
Okay, so let me ask you this. When we're using it to do historical research, sure. Is there a way that the program can understand the weight of a certain person? So let's take the show I just did about Wall Street, banks, and U.S. foreign policy, written by Murray Rothbard. Now, you can clearly see, based on how the piece is structured, that some people do carry more weight as far as their connections and their influence. J.P. Morgan, John Rockefeller. You can see the weight, but then you also see these other names that just keep coming up again, 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 again. Love it. who I'm unfamiliar with prior to reading this. I don't know who he is. So I'm not really understanding as I'm going, because there is this frequency, like this buzz of all these names and all these organizations and all, right, in all these places.
So you need to go unlock each one of those kind of one by one.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say you know Leavitt, but you don't know about Forrestal.
Okay.
And so then you start to learn, oh, I know a little bit about this guy. Now let me, you know, research somebody who's close. Oh, wow, this guy died under mysterious circumstances. And, you know, his wife was at this guy's house, and this guy's in Skull and Bones and CIA. There's all these connections. So I would say the weight of a person, at least in my model, because I model on influence. So if somebody influences somebody else, they would be above. If this person influenced somebody else, that other person will be below.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's kind of hierarchical. But you'd see by the number of connections or who they're connected to. Or in the case of Council on Foreign Relations or the Rothschild Banking Empire, or the Rockefeller Banking Empire, which are all in the same model, the number of connections, the number of people they're influencing that are in high positions that are household names becomes obvious. And you can also go into a deeper depth. You can color code connections. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can do in there. But when you're just taking in raw data, say you're watching a documentary, and you're like, wow, this is fascinating. I usually just bring up the brain model and I start learning. So I'm not just watching the documentary and letting stuff go by. I'm pausing things, looking stuff up, adding them to the brain model. And I kind of design most of my media in that same vein, whether it's Peace Revolution or the History Show. I expect people, if you encounter something you're not familiar with, hit pause. Mm-hmm. That's why we're not broadcasting live. You can hit pause, play, forward, rewind, whatever you want. And you can actually go look that up. Add it to your own brain model. And then as you're consuming the things that we've produced, you're actually building out your model. Your model is your understanding of your environment, which is related to your self-confidence, your self-esteem, and your self-reliance. And so as you start to exercise your mind and it starts to respond, I've only seen positive results thus far from learning.
Absolutely. And the other thing too, you were talking about kind of getting rid of the noise, filtering out the noise. And I'd like to hear Paul's thoughts on this in a minute as well. But, you know, even when the signal to noise ratio is very high, like when I'm listening to you and Kevin talk about the developments in the 20th century, or I'm listening to Murray Rothbard talk about banking and Wall Street.
Can you understand the signal? Even if it's really clear, are you able to take
it? The signal is so heavy. Like, for example, in those last two shows in that How the Truth Became Illegal series, and I'm talking about the addendum that I put out today with the article by Murray Rothbard and the show that I did with Rich and Kevin back in July, I asked, and I'm extrapolating here from a sample, my audience to absorb over 500 names, over 50 organizations, and over 100 places, over 100 locations. So
but
now that's all
bad if it's all new to them. Mm-hmm. If they're familiar with a couple, then let's just go into the next couple layers, because this is a life sport that we're doing here, learning.
Yeah,
it's a life sport. It's going to take time. You're going to be able to add a couple people at a time, because even if you were to sit down and take that entire document and put it all in the brain model, mm-hmm. I mean, you would have an amazing recall. I mean, I think people would be surprised with how much they could remember after reading through Wikipedia pages and doing the links themselves, like
yeah.
we just showed them in that short tutorial that we did upstairs.
Right, right.
But the other idea is that you and I at some point could sit down, listen to the recent podcast that you put out on the Rothbard, and we could actually brain model it live, like screen capture it, and then we could put it out with the audio. And so people could see real time. You just consumed 2 hours of media. And it took, 8 hours to model it or whatever. And here's, here's how it went on. And, I don't know if I want to spend 8 hours doing that, but I've done it in the past. Like, that's how my model got to be my model. So if I want other people to learn from that, I guess I should show them how we actually do it.
Right.
Because it does. It takes time because you got to read. But I could read some stuff out loud. We could comment on it. And, we'd screen capture. I think it would make a great tutorial that other people, not everyone's going to do it, but if, 10 people do it, then that's 10 more people that are, headed in the right direction.
Right, right. And these are all, they can be integrated with each other, too.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Two brains can merge.
Brains can merge, as weird as that sounds in the brain world, personal brain world. There is a trickiness that you have to have a certain, if you're going to enter in a name, you have to, if it's William T. Stead, and W.T. Stead in the other model, you're going to end up with two of those dudes in your model. So you have to reconcile and say, no, this guy is this guy. And, you might have to do some matching. It can be complex, but it is possible.
Sure.
It has been done.
There's definitely a lot of value in terms of, filtering out what stuff isn't going to serve you. I think you're trying to memorize stuff. I think everyone, or the majority of people, although I have no evidence to back this up, they, over the course of their lifetime, will tend to remember the names of several hundred actors or sports stars or musicians or people in their high school. And so our brains are equipped to remember several hundred identifying facts of just people's names, right? And so, again, if you can create a memory palace or use something like the brain where you create these buildings in your memory and then you're housing all this, all the people or the ideas or the philosophies kind of in a hierarchical pattern, then you can train your brain, and it's actually not that difficult to be able to recall these things, because you're visualizing yourself walking through this, you know, mansion or palace or whatever, and each room has a different associated thought, an anchored thought. So you might have Bill Clinton and George Bush and all these different presidents, and then each president could be associated with someone else, and then you start to see, you basically want to see where the correlations come, right? Where are the overlaps? Where are the associations? It doesn't mean guilt by association, but it means opportunity by association, right? So you're saying, oh, these two guys were in the same secret society together in the same year, and they had a business together. Okay, that's a strong correlation, right? Mm-hmm. That means that they had a deeper connection than just two guys who went to university 3 years apart, right?
Sure. And there's this parody of the conspiracy theorists that I think we see in television and you know, even mainstream news all the time, where people are just kind of making these flimsy connections between people, like one connection, one line, one bridge. Yeah. Might not necessarily mean that much, but two or three or four. And then when you can see the tangled web they weave, as you kind of broaden it outward, that does start to show you that connections can mean something, right?
Yeah, well, it goes from speculation to possibility to probability to, you know, proof, essentially, right? One connection is a bit, but once you get up to two or three or four, like you said, then it starts to beg a lot of questions, and you start to be able to make a stronger case because those new connections can create new patterns of their own, right? You can see if these 15 guys all belong to not only this secret society, but they belong to these same five think tanks and working groups, mm-hmm. and then you notice that there's an agenda being promoted, you know, unilaterally through those different groups, well, then it's pretty easy to extrapolate what's kind of going on, right? What kind of interest they're serving, at least, right? And then you can look for the funding connections or the, you know, there's all these different levels of connection for people to understand.
I have an example, Polly. I was just thinking about what's a great example to show people that's not Skull and Bones. Yeah. There's this guy called John Negroponte. He's the brother of Nicholas Negroponte, who's a famous technocrat.
Mm-hmm.
Nicholas Negroponte was educated at Le Rosay, which is an elite Swiss school that is very, very up there. It's where it's the School of Kings, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not a slap in the face to people who are autonomous, it's the School of Kings, and you're not one. But Negroponte, Porter Goss, William H.T. Bucky Bush, Bush uncle that's a war profiteer. All these guys were in a Yale secret society, as well as, there's some CIA activity there, Operation 40. So my point is that these guys are in a secret society at Yale, PsyOps Lawn. I think the secret society was known as Wolf's Head, but I'll have to check, because I remember seeing Porter Goss, Bucky Bush, and John Negroponte all in the same picture together back mm-hmm. in, like, 1965. And then post 9/11, all these guys are holding, you know, either national security positions in a very, very, very high level of government under national security, like at the highest level in history, and or war profiteering. Like, it's not accidental that those relationships happen to be profitable in that line of business, because that's what they're being groomed for through the education system in their case.
Now, I'm very impressed with your recall ability. And there's some people who are very, very good at this. And I haven't fancied myself as being really competent in this respect yet. So I'm always impressed by how you can find something that relates to what we're talking about and then broaden it to explain the context that also fits into. Now, it seems like using the brain, which you're referencing there, it does a pretty decent job of replicating and modeling our recall process. In other words, like, so you have some name, like, let's just completely change the subject. I'm thinking about the Stalinist Russia, and I say Dmitry Shostakovich. So I start typing Shostakovich, right? And there it comes up, right, as a brain, and all these connections, just like our memories start to say, okay, now that I think of this thing, here's what surrounds that. Here's, you know, where the synapses
you can
go.
It too, if you can't remember the name. And you can search it too. If you can't remember the name and just part of it, you can search through the brain. Or if you can, I don't remember whose name it was, but I remember that they used to work with this guy or they went to school with this guy or whatever the connection might be. And then you can also just, you know, search in that way. So it not only aids your ability, your mind's ability to grow into learning and remembering more readily, but if it doesn't work out that way, let's say that for some reason it just doesn't happen in here, you have it over here.
Mm-hmm.
I have it over here. If I forget and I draw a blank, it only takes me a second or so. I can type it in and then, you know, I'm going again. Because it doesn't matter how much you can really recall so much as do you know where to find the answers and can you find them as quickly?
Absolutely. Because you've got an effective way of storing it.
It's about survival.
So, Paul, I'll ask you first and then get Rich's thoughts. Do you feel like since you've been using this, there's actually been improvements in your ability to not only do the recall, but make the connections without, you know, going into a reference file?
Definitely. It's been able to create kind of a deeper anchor with different thoughts because, you know, reading something in a book and then reading something in another book and putting it together inside your head is one thing. You kind of solidify the connection. But seeing a visual representation when your brain is essentially taking visual snapshots of almost everything it sees, it really gives you the opportunity to really nail that thought and those associations down in your brain. And, you know, a lot of technology can make our brains lazier because we become dependent on it. Like cell phones, you know, people don't remember phone numbers anymore because they put all the numbers into their contact list and they stop forgetting or they stop remembering numbers. But with the brain, because you can revisit it and you're constantly re-seeing the connections, it's updating yourself as you update the external version of what you're thinking or what you're seeing these connections between. So super, super useful. I definitely have found benefit in not only being able to organize things for myself, but in order to show people an idea or to give them a visual representation that you can't always explain adequately from your own thoughts, right? This gives you an opportunity to let people search through something themselves and see how they're associated. Mm-hmm. And then they can draw some of their own connections as well. And they might realize things that you didn't even see, right? Because there's all these levels of context that we can look at stuff instead of just the surface level. Oh, I went off.
Yeah, it sounds simple, but you know, new learning is the best brain exercise. And I saw this TED Talk that I recommend to people. I think the guy's name was Dan Amen, and it was called Change Your Brain, Change Your Life. And he says, you know, as soon as like you get into these periods of apathy where you're not learning new things, the brain starts to disconnect. And we know that, like, you know, riding a bike is like riding a bike, but most other things aren't. You know, I picked up a guitar here last night and I said, this ain't like riding a bike, because those connections, the undergrowth has come in and filled them back in. And this is how I always explained it to young people as far as habits and learning new things, is that the first time you walk through the woods, it sucks, right? Because there's logs and there's all that underbrush and there's sticks in your face. The 20th time you walk through, it's a path. And, you know, the brain is very similar in that respect. So to keep the brain learning, you know, keeps those connections intact. It keeps those paths open. And I think you spoke about that, Rich, when you talked about actually going through the process of building the brain and making these connections, that it helps actually connect those synapses.
Well, I think, you know, the two things it helps you do is it helps you build context. So by learning about one thing, you have to learn about these other things.
Yeah.
Because that's what this one thing is about. And you have to know how it's similar and how it's different to compare and contrast it and find that. But there's also the idea of how much data do you need to make that decision and move on? Like some people say, well, you just study history and when are you going to stop? Well, first off, I'm not going to stop learning. Secondly, my job is to collect all the valid data so that when presented to people, it's beyond reasonable doubt. Like, we have plenty of data on this topic and can show you all the relevant evidence that exists, and that should be enough for anyone and move on. And I don't think any parts of the model are there yet, but as I continue to fill in the blanks by reading books and taking what I'm reading and putting it in the brain, and I don't put every single thing that's in a book in there, but the major themes, major people involved, if somebody worked on the Pentagon Papers, if somebody was working on Operation Paperclip, if some newspaper editor was working in Operation Mockingbird, or, you know, these sort of things, these are useful things because you don't want to have to relearn that later. And what could be the cost if you forget that? Oh, you might believe something in there without taking with a grain of salt and knowing that it has been a mouthpiece for intelligence agencies since the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, anything to add there?
Yep, and it lets you stay organized in a way that's multi-layered. I think if people start practicing kind of multi-layered thinking and recognizing there's times for sort of like shallow cursory thinking and there's times for really deep introspective thinking, then they'll realize that there's the tools, whether it's color coding or tags or these different things that can let you kind of replicate those qualities in the brain software, so you can not only organize things whatever fashion that your own brain happens to think things, I guess, but you can also organize it in whatever way you can change that those habits. You can change it to a different way of organization and then share it with people, which is, I think, beneficial.
Sure. And just to piggyback on what Rich said, I think that lasting memories really do come from the establishment of connections. School does a lot of things wrong, sure. But, you know, even in elementary school, we learn about mnemonics, you know, PEMDAS, you know, so there's a connection. It's a made up word that connects these different ideas in a way that we can remember it. So the ability to make connections is very, very valuable in forming lasting memories.
Well, I think the other issue at hand is it's not only informing lasting memories, but it's being able to be responsible intellectually about topics that might be of mutual concern. I see a lot of people getting upset over things that they see on the news. Mm-hmm. And yet if I ask them the basic grammar questions of that situation, oh, you're all upset because you think Snowden's a traitor. Great. Like, who is Snowden? Where's he worked? Like, what's the agenda in play? When he goes to, you know, Hong Kong and Russia, does he know that Western technology had funded all that and that he's not running anywhere outside of the system that's been created? I mean, so there's certain naivetes going on. And so in order to understand any of these situations, you know, what is the history of the NSA? Where does that come from? Who founded that? He used to work for the CIA. Who founded that? What's their agenda? What are these things going on? And especially when you get to asking those questions about, like, modern terrorism, it comes up that it doesn't necessarily end where people think it ends. There's another part of the story that brings it back closer to home. And without doing your homework, you're going to be playing, you know, you're chance you'd be playing on the wrong side of the team.
Sure. And when people don't really have you know, too much confidence in their beliefs because they haven't done this research, what we have there is what we talked about in our last show. You have this knowledge gap. You have this hole that needs to be filled. And somebody comes along and they pat you on the head and they say the CIA is there to protect you from bad guys. And you say, oh, that fits in that hole I had nicely. You know, thank you. It's full. And that's a, you know, the busyness and the buzz of life. Sometimes people, they don't want to sit there and dwell and worry about these things. And they think that that's unhealthy because they don't have a method to fill that hole properly. So somebody comes along with a prepackaged explanation and they say, here, rest easy. Your hole is filled.
But don't we have a moral responsibility to live our lives based on truth?
Absolutely. You know, I think we do, but most people don't know that.
People's rights.
I mean, yeah.
That's Amtssprache. That's what the Nazis did and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
That's stimulus response without thinking. I mean, that's outsourcing your thoughts, and outsourcing your thoughts is immoral.
Absolutely. And folks, I'm not advocating the haphazard filling of these holes, you know, so irresponsibly. I am seconding what Rich is saying for sure about, you know, taking the time to do that research and understand the roots and understand the history of some of these organizations so you can see what the CIA is really all about, what the NSA is really all about. So you don't have to accept these superficial, you know, explanations, and just to be able to move on. You can really understand and then proceed confidently forward with, you know, more information and ultimately a better understanding of a bigger picture.
And if people want to understand in, like, a simple way what the modus operandi, the motives and intentions are, because I think, you know, movies and propaganda have made the intelligence agencies into these kind of like necessities and super agencies, and they're serving some moral purpose. But it's really a revolving door. It's business people who've dreamed of getting into government or intelligence so that they can use those positions to create opportunities for when they get back into business or for their buddies to get into business. And that's all national security means. It means protecting the monetary interests of big corporations who've, most of whom kind of bullied their way to their positions, right? So they're using these, it's an apparatus that's been created to give it legitimacy, to go in and protect national interests, like overthrowing Mossadegh in 53 to protect interests, right? But it's BP's interests. Why does a petroleum company in Britain get more rights than anyone else, right? So, you know, being aware of that level of context definitely makes it easier to understand why certain actions happen.
Sure. The revolving door is a very rational explanation, and it's, you know, it's ubiquitous in government for sure. But there's also people who are just kind of dangerously playing out these power fantasies. You know, I mean, if you're listening to this in the distant future, Bloomberg Island used to be called Manhattan many years ago. And I think that's a prime example of somebody who just had a bunch of money and a bunch of time and wanted to basically act out these power fantasies. We see a lot of that, too.
But they get organized. We're not talking about people who make outlines and nothing ever comes of them and they end up in a drawer.
Like, sure.
These people are organized to the nth degree. And that's where we need to start to take back our own personal productivity, because without that, we're left to have someone else structure our time and tell us when's a good time to sit in front of the couch and a TV and all this other stuff that goes on if you just leave it as stimulus response. And so by, you know, cutting that in half and having stimulus, thinking, and then response, it greatly improves your life, because you are able to start to actually have your life and not the life that you've been acting out that's been a marketing script that's been fed and reiterated and acted out, you know, a million different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about taking back individual personality, and along with that comes individual responsibility. But the force within the space between your two ears, that force of thinking, is what leads to constructive change in the world. And when you have that force absent, when that void is there to be filled, that's where the unconstructive things in the world seem to fester.
Sure. And if we just want to change our terminology back to some words we used earlier in the show, you know, the stimulus are these inputs. And if we can't manage the inputs, life gets very chaotic. And then that processing space closes and there really is no productive outputs.
I think you also have to consider the benefits of being able to capture your general grammar on a topic. And it's not just a bunch of tabs on your browser. You're able to drag these tabs and have them in relationships to each other, influential down, like from top down, from this person down to this person, with this person that they know that they work with, but they're not influencing. And then you have structure to it. That structure adds and aids in the context in your mind, making these new synapses, and your ability to constructively handle larger, complex situations like that which we're faced with in life,
mm-hmm.
On a more graceful and elegant level, where you can speak eloquently about these topics without having to look directly at it. Because if it's in my brain, I kind of remember a lot of things, a lot of its attributes. I might not remember everything about it or what it's connected to, but I can remember enough, at least if I had to type in and recall it, click through it, or to start speaking and kind of have it brought back to my memory by, you know, speaking out the connections. It's like, all right, you start to, you know, recall it that way sometimes too.
Paul?
Well, I was gonna quote something that I think Rich quoted before, which was John Taylor Gatto talking about stop living someone else's script and start writing your own. And part of writing your own script is doing it in an organized way and making sure that you understand not only what connections are out there, but the quality of the connections, right? Not only understanding the context of events and people, the who, what, when, where, but getting to understand the why and understanding how things happen. And, you know, the brain is just yet another tool to aid in communicating ideas, both to others and back to yourself. So, you know, I'm sure there's many other tools out there to communicate ideas, but this is one of the useful ones. And you can do it locally on your machine, I should mention. Although you can do online versions, I'm sure, The fact that you can do it locally on your machine means you're, all these ideas and things that you're putting into a mind map, you're not necessarily putting out onto the World Wide Web for others to build like profiles of your understanding. It's a local thing that you can save and encrypt or do whatever you want with. So,
well, I would also add that I have what's called the Web Brain, which is a my brain model from my desktop, and it's published online. You can click through and you can click into the attachments. You just can't add anything in or change it. So as a reference, it's out there. It's for free. The model that I have that I built in the software, anyone can purchase for $30. You get a couple other free models that I made, a time management model, these sort of things to play with to help structure. And that's where you can start adding in, or you can just download the software for free from the personal, I think it's thebrain.com is the website, but it's called the personal.
Yeah.
And you can download it and use it for free for everything except publishing to the web, but you can make models and share models and do all these useful things. So I think the importance are it's online or on your local Mac or PC. It's interactive, so it's not just static. You can click through it, you can click into it, you can learn, and if you get the software, you can add stuff to it. The quality and the quantity of what you can do with it is very impressive, but I think also you could revisit a topic. Let's say you remember something about something you entered in there. Let's say you were studying the RMS Titanic and you remember that there was this connection with William T. Stead, but you don't remember what it was. You can actually go into the model and say, oh, where was my source for that? What are the other things that I'm neglecting to recall? And so it's like if you've done the work once, like thinking's hard enough. So if you've done the work once, store it someplace. So if you ever have to go through that same process, you can go back and find, you know, your line of reasoning and kind of click through it. So those are reasons I find it useful.
Absolutely.
You can get fresh reminders before ideas go stale.
Right, right.
To use a bread analogy, which I love.
So how'd your diagram work out over there? You know?
Okay, well, what I drew just for demonstration purposes here is a mind map.
Yeah.
Okay,
you have to say that dude's name every time you say mind map.
Brought to you by Tony Buzan and Taco Bell.
Tony Buzan.
Brought to you by Carl's Jr.
Brought to you, yeah.
So a mind map is a more freeform outline that allows you to make connections across the spectrum. That's the idea. So it's similar in many ways to what the brain is. Unfortunately, a mind map does start with a central idea like the brain does, but you can click on anything within the brain and it turns it into the central idea and then automatically creates a new mind map for you. So, you know, mind maps are really not just for...
You got to say that guy's name every time.
Tony Buzan's mind maps are really... not just about research integration, but creativity and you know, being able to innovate and to see new insights. So the brain is a technological improvement on that idea.
Take that, Tony Buzan. Why do we have to say his name afterwards?
He copyrighted it.
Is he going to sue us if we don't say it?
I don't know.
Good luck. I got nothing to say. Good. Waste your time.
He is a brain model of everyone who's ever used the word mind map. All connected. And there's the people who used it in a way that was sort of passively aggressive, and then the other people he's just going to nail to the wall.
So a couple of closing questions here. Have you learned anything interesting about your thinking process through using the brain? Because, I mean, you've been at it for a while, Paul.
I had no idea that I had it. I mean, let's put it just frankly.
Yeah.
For the first 30 years of my life, until some really traumatic events happened, I was pretty much stimulus response and had no reason to think or question because I thought I knew everything because I was taught with declarative sentences. And doesn't that make sense? It's all good. Don't think about it.
Yeah.
But then once you start using the question mark, wow, man, your life starts to change because now, you got to find answers, and those answers aren't what you've been taught. And you're starting to grow up and go through the rite of passage that most people are denied until it's called a midlife crisis, where they're so far down the road of life they can't do anything about it when they find out what's going on. So take the advantage, learn earlier than 30. I would recommend, you know, in mid 20s would be a great time to get in touch with reality if you haven't already. I mean, that would be a good time. Don't go wasting too much of your life thinking it's all just fun and games. There's some very serious things going on that we haven't been taught about. And to even start to deal with that, we have to start with ourselves, become balanced, know thyself, know how to learn anything for ourselves, which gives us true self-confidence and self-esteem, which allows us to work and play nicely with others and use nonviolent communication, or at least is what I call voluntary communication, the non-use of obligatory words in your communication with people that you're interacting with. So it's getting your hands on you know, this toolbox of essential tools that are all based around the same three-step process of input, processing, and output. And then once you start to integrate these tools, your life can start to unfold and blossom, or whatever metaphor you want, but it's a lot cooler than the static, you know, kind of flat line that most people, or, you know, stimulus response. You're waiting for TV to tell you when to be excited or upset, or everyone's upset about this story right now or whatever. It's like, that's herd mentality, and that's dangerous. And we as individuals mm-hmm. need to identify that and stay away from it to keep us safe. And it would really make us safe if we get there to be less people in the herd. That would be great. I don't think if people had a conscious understanding of what's going on that they would want to be subject to stimulus response and have their lives denied to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think that as long as people had the chance to learn, there was hope.
Excellent. Paul, how about you? Same question. You mentioned that prior to being introduced to this, you felt like you were somewhat disorganized. Have you learned anything about your individual thinking process through integrating this model into your organizational system?
I would say definitely. The reason being, I wasn't aware of the term autodidactism, autodidactic thinking or learning. And as I began to kind of piece together that might be the style that I'm most comfortable with, I realized that just like a student, you know, a pupil needs pens and papers and, you know, all your little school supplies as tools really to help you in your learning, that autodidacts need tools as well, right? You need an ability to connect to information. That's a practical concern, but you also need the internal mechanics essentially to have that intellectual self-defense so that all the information you come across, you're able to sort properly, to consider properly, to communicate properly. And, you know, you get these navigation tools, they, you know, whether it's a map, a compass, a gyroscope, all these things that can keep you balanced and focused and aware of your surroundings. That's increased for me, especially in the last 3 years. Like I put out a film, where I thought I'd done a lot of critical thinking and due diligence on, and, you know, I look back at it like 5 years later and I feel like, you know, what I really, really didn't have the same depth or quality of understanding critical thinking and of really separating speculation versus like stuff you've really done satisfactory research on. So that's been kind of a wake-up call, because every time you think you hit a new plateau, you kind of think you figured it all out. Yeah. And realizing that, no, you haven't figured it all out. You have yet another plateau to reach, and probably another one after that, another one after that. And so you don't give up on the quest. You just go, you have to be prepared to check your ego when you're encountering information that might radically change your viewpoints or the way that you conduct yourself.
Your ego is not your amigo. Put right. it in the back seat. Don't let it drive.
Well said.
Yeah, well said.
Well, we've covered everything that I hope to cover tonight. I want to thank you both for your participation. I hope this is useful to the people who are watching this on YouTube or listening to it as a podcast. I hope you'll check out the video. I
think it certainly looks and sounds a lot better than what we were about to try to do on Ustream. So it's better that we pre-taped it because we have higher quality, and that gives it longevity. People can hear this far into the future loud and clear.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, guys, and thanks for watching. And there'll be more coming soon as far as these tools are concerned.
So that was the end, everybody. I highly recommend, once again, that you check out at least the video tutorial, which is available in the show notes for this podcast on schoolsucksproject.com. You can also check us out tonight on Truth Exposed Radio. We'll be filling in as the host. It's a show, live call-in show out of Austin, Texas. So I'll throw a link up in the show notes if you're interested in seeing how you can stream that from your location. If you're not in Austin, Texas, or the surrounding area, you know how radio works. All right. Talk to you again soon. Do 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 do